Hi, this is Katie Day, and welcome to Creating Ripples, the programme that showcases inspirational women across the globe. Sometimes it is the small acts and achievements that can create the biggest ripples. We're here to share some amazing stories. They will make you laugh, sometimes they may make you cry. They will always inspire you. Today, it is my absolute pleasure to be interviewing Jessica McGregor Johnson. Jessica is an international life guide, mentor, and coach. She is also the author of two books, The Right T-Shirt, Write Your Own Rules, and Live the Life You Want, and Remembering Perfection, Everyday Inspiration for Living Your Life Spiritually. Jessica helps people who are experiencing the wake-up call, just as she did over 25 years ago. Like her all that time ago, people who are at crossroads in their life, they know that there must be more meaning in life than they are currently feeling. Working with her, people discover themselves anew, identify their true passions and how to live them, whether it be in their work or their personal life. Jessica has a variety of programs and works with people on the phone anywhere in the world, as well as offering her bespoke individual retreats in southern Spain. She is known for her accessible wisdom and insight and leaves her clients feeling nurtured and excited about the new future they are stepping into. Welcome, Jessica. Thank you, Katie, for being interviewed. I love the description of you. You're helping people experiencing the wake-up call, just as you did over 25 years ago. So I think that's where we need to start. What was your wake-up call 25 years ago?
Oh, goodness me. Okay. Well, lovely to be with you, Katie. And my wake-up call happened when I got to, 25 years ago would have made me nearly 30 or 33. And I had literally ticked most of the boxes that I had been told to tick that would create happiness in my life.
I love that, told to tick.
And what it was, you know, do this, and you'll be happy.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had the marriage, I had the very good job, I had, you know, 3 holidays a year, I had nice new cars, I had a thatched cottage with the roses over the door, and I shall never forget the moment when I literally drove my new car up the hill, looking down on this beautiful little hamlet in Wiltshire, and realised I was miserable.
Wow.
I was just miserable. And at that time, actually, I was also very angry because I had ticked all the boxes and I'd worked incredibly hard to tick them really early in my life so I would have this very happy life. And I was absolutely devastated that actually it didn't make me happy at all. It all felt incredibly empty. And around the same time, an old friend of mine who I'd known for many years turned up and I hadn't seen him for a long time. And he said to me, what are you going to be doing when you're 60?
Wow, what a question.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was like, you know, and I was literally, you know, I wasn't who I am now. It was a different person, different lifetime. I was Material Girl 101. and he asked me this question, what are you going to be, what are you going to do when you're 60? And I went, well, what I'm doing now, of course. And he looked at me and he said, do you like what you're doing now? And I went, no. So he said, so why do you want to be doing it when you're 60? And I was like, oh, expletive.
Damn you for asking that question.
Exactly. Damn you for asking.
What were you doing? What was your career?
I was working in a company that sold advertising. I was the manager of the telephone sales department. I trained and recruited salespeople. I've been doing it for 14 years. I was exceptionally well paid. And I just realized at that moment that I really couldn't carry on doing this and just carry on living that life anymore. And it was a really hard decision to make because everybody's expectations was in me playing this game.
Yep. And it is playing a game. I mean, you've hit the nail on the head, isn't it? When I work with people, I say that any time usually between about 35 and 45, people can, not everybody does, but people who are awake and aware to what's going on in their lives will stop and think, hang on a minute, whose life am I living? Just remind me. And they realize that they have been living the first half of their life to fulfill the expectations of other people and not living the life to fulfill the expectations of themselves. But not everybody has that realization.
I don't think I even knew that I could have expectations of myself.
Ah, that's the key, isn't it?
And that's often the case with people.
Yeah.
And that's why there's such confusion when it happens to people, because they're like, well, I've done everything. I've fulfilled my duty. I mean, I had somebody on retreat recently and she said, you know, my whole life has been duty.
Yeah.
And I'm like, and how does that work for you? And she said, not very well. But she didn't even know until it got to such a point of just such dysfunction. She didn't even know that there might be another way.
Right.
And I think that's what the wake-up call does. It's something that happens that's so almost like radical at the time that you just think, oh, this can't be it.
Once you've had that realization and that wake-up call, how do you move to giving yourself permission to do something about it?
Well, I think you need help, really. I think it's very, very hard to go through alone. Mm. I know I did. I'm kind of a bit of a radical person. So when that question was asked about what do you want to do when you're 60, and I realized, ugh, not this. I mean, I literally packed two suitcases and left.
Did you really?
Yeah.
How soon after being asked that question?
Probably about a month or so.
Wow.
Because I say to people, you don't have to do it that way. There is probably better ways to do it. I'm just like, that's my character of who I was at the time, and probably am now. So then I was literally holding on. I can remember, in fact, it was really interesting. I had to do a very large presentation at work. I should never forget this. And I hadn't told anybody that I'd left other than my best friend. Nobody at work knew. I just had this mask on. Literally, like I was battling my way through it and my life was in ruins behind me, but nobody had to know that. And I remember doing this huge presentation and the CEO of the company coming up to me afterwards, he said, people normally look relieved when they've just done something like that. You don't look any better than you did this morning.
Yeah, bless you for that feedback.
But he was saying it in a loving way. And I went, and I told him, and he went, oh my God, why didn't you tell us? We could have helped you. And it hadn't occurred to me that I could tell anybody that I could ask for help. But him saying that made me realise that actually I did need to ask for help because I was floundering. I knew what I didn't want, but I had no idea what I wanted.
So when you say you packed two suitcases after a month and left, you're talking about you walked out on the marriage?
Yeah.
But you hadn't walked out on the job at that point?
No, not at
okay.
that point.
Okay.
And I think that was a really interesting, with hindsight, I had to have one bit of stability.
Right, yeah.
And I think that's very, very key. And when I'm talking to people about the wake-up call, I'm always looking for what is the ground they're going to stand on as the rest of their world shifts and changes.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's their relationship, sometimes it's their job, sometimes it's their friends or their families, but something. I think we all need that stable place to stand.
Yeah.
So that we can make those changes.
Yeah.
And that was a real decision of mine, particularly after I started to kind of really look at what I wanted, was to actually kind of go, okay, I don't like the job anymore, but I'm not changing that because I need to make this shift standing on solid ground.
Right, okay. And leaving the marriage was more of a driver than leaving the job first and staying
yes.
in the marriage. Okay.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I stayed in the job probably another 2.5-3 years.
Oh, did you? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, absolutely. Because for me, that wake-up call was it was a huge wake-up call. I mean, I went on to do personal development courses and really kind of explore who I was. I'd never even looked at who I was before. And then I had subsequent wake-up calls after that.
Yeah, I bet.
They built. And during that whole time when I was going into that first, you know, exploration of who I was and what was I doing on this planet and all those questions, huge, huge questions, the who am I questions that you can have, I needed that stability to be able to do that. And then... there just came a day well, I should never forget one day I just knew, okay, I don't need the job anymore. I've got enough information about who I am and what I want out of life that I can move on. And it was really interesting because very soon after that, a friend of mine came to me and she was opening a retreat site down in Somerset. And she said to me, would you like to come and run my retreat site for me? And I was like, yeah, okay. And so, and then that led to yet more. But, you know, those lovely progressions that happen in life. Yeah. And it was always like, but what was interesting is that I got very clear that I didn't want to be in the corporate world anymore. I wanted to be in the caring world, for want of a better word. I wanted to be in something that made a difference in the world. And it came, as soon as I got that clarity, up it popped. And it was there it was.
If that friend hadn't asked you that question, do you think your life would be different today?
Yes and no. I think that it might have taken longer, but I'm a great believer that if you're, you know, I couldn't have carried on. I could have carried on if I'd wanted to be really miserable. But I think if he hadn't asked that question, I think something else would have asked that question.
Right.
I think we come in our own personal evolution as a spirit or a soul, or whatever you want to call it. There comes a time in a life that you're going to have that wake up.
Okay.
And how it comes, it's almost like almost immaterial in a way. And so I'm a great believer that when it comes for a reason. And we can ignore it.
Well, I was going to say that people may have the wake up calls at a different point in your life, but not everybody has the courage to listen to them.
It'll just come round again.
And we can still ignore it because that is, you know, what one thing about human nature is we, even people who say I love change, there is a resistance to change. And even if you know something isn't working in your benefit, it's sometimes safer than doing something differently because it's familiar. And there's a lot of safety in familiarity, even though you know it's not supportive of your journey. So even though the wake-up calls keep coming bang, 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 and they're probably getting bigger and louder, people can still choose to say, shut up, and keep going.
And
which I guess is where you get your clients. How your clients are like that, perhaps.
Yeah,
are they?
A lot. Well, some of them are. Yes, some of them have had quite a few and now have a big one.
Right.
Some of them have recognised it early, but there will be people who have these wake up calls who don't listen this time round. And that's and it's interesting. I think those are particularly the people who probably get to their, you know, the end of their life and go, oh no, oh really? Yeah. What didn't I do?
Yeah.
What, you know, I didn't allow love in. I didn't go for what I wanted and die probably with a lot of regrets in their lives.
You know, sadly, I think that's probably the higher percentage of the population, the global population. So what are the things that you say to your clients that maybe you said to yourself that when these messages are coming at us and we have the opportunity to change our lives and to press that pause button and reassess, what are the things that you would advise people to listen out for and how they deal with those messages when they first get them?
I think one of the things that I always say to people is that that message will come with a physical sensation.
Right.
And often those physical sensations are actually stronger than words. Mm-hmm. We just start to feel very uncomfortable with our lives.
And what sort of physical sensations? Can you give an example?
You know that kind of physical sensations are very personal. But for me, I just feel like I'm squirming.
All right. You
know? It's like, oh no, this just doesn't feel right.
Okay.
You know, and I think for some people it might be a really heavy leaded feeling in their stomach.
Okay.
You know, anything like that. Because I think what happens is that we can ignore situations, but it's very hard to ignore the physical alarm bells that we have. So that's always one of the things to look out for. And it's very much around realizing that when you have that realization, when you kind of go, okay, this really isn't working, whatever this is, to not think that you have to completely change every single thing in your life, because that's right. often a major fear with people. Yeah. I'm going to lose my job, my family, my friends, yeah. you know, everything. And it's like, no. Hold on, breathe, calm down. I have a lot of people who come to me and they think they have to change all these major things in their life. And what I say to them when I first speak to them is like, that is a possibility, but it's not a probability.
Yeah.
I said, there's a huge difference. I said, you might have to change one of the things, or you might be like some people that I work with, who the only thing they change is who they're choosing to be in their life, rather than what you're choosing to do in your life.
So are you saying that there is an option to not actually change the external life, but change how we cope and live within it? So our yes. attitude towards it.
Our attitude towards it and who we're choosing to be. I mean, it probably will be about also changing work-life balance, because that's a lot of the time when we get so out of balance with everything else. But very interestingly, it's often about who we're choosing to be and our perceptions of our world around us.
So it's our view of the world, is that a map of the world, and what we believe and what we put out there externally, we're likely to get reflected back to us. So if we're giving out anger, resentment and bitterness and discontentment, then we're going to get more of that coming back to us. But if we change what goes on inside our head and our attitude towards our external situation, then we will reflect a different set of reactions and we will look for different things. We'll look for evidence
yeah.
differently. We'll look for different evidence.
Exactly. That's exactly it. And then building on that, there's also the situation of how we respond to something or how we perceive something.
Yeah.
I want to give you an example because it's the easiest way to do this. I had somebody who came out on retreat with me, and I knew that when she came, there wasn't a lot of wiggle room in what was going on in her life, but there was a lot of wiggle room of how she perceived her life.
Right.
And so we looked at, for example, one of the things was the work that she did and the person that she worked with. And everything had felt like, you know, this heavy weight on her shoulders and everything else. And we talked about it. We talked about how the idea of responsibility is how you have the ability to respond to something.
Yeah.
And it's not something that's put upon you. It's a choice. Now, that might sound kind of light in some ways, but for her that was a huge shift in how she perceived her working relationship.
Okay.
And what was really interesting is that she went home with that and that working relationship, simply because she addressed it differently, completely changed.
Right. Yeah.
And she said, even though I'm doing virtually the same work as I did before, I feel completely different about what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Because of how I'm turning up.
Yeah.
So, yes, the wake-up call could mean big, big change. And for some people it does. I've had people completely change their life, move country, everything.
Wow.
And it also might mean externally, doesn't look like hardly anything's happening at all.
Interesting. So people don't have to be terrified if they think they're getting that wake-up call. And to realise actually they have control of how they react to that wake-up call. And it doesn't have to be an all or nothing. It can be a gentle. And I think, do you believe and have you seen that people struggle to be gentle with themselves?
Oh, yeah. People are really good at beating themselves up. And what's very interesting is that people who are experiencing the whole wake-up call thing have then make the past 40 years a complete mistake.
Yeah.
I've just wasted 40 years of my life. And they go into this real, if I have to kind of drag them out of it, whoa, don't go there. But that's where they want to go. Because they've got to a place in their life where they now want to change something, they make everything else they've done previously wrong.
Right.
And give themselves a really hard time for it. And I'm like, no, that's not what this is about. This is about your personal evolution. This is about the fact that you needed to go through those experiences to get to where you are today, to be able to be on this wonderful launch pad to go into something amazing and new. If you hadn't had all those experiences, you wouldn't be on the launch pad.
It's difficult though for people to get there, isn't it? Because if they want to radically change their lives, it's human nature to want to rationalise that. And one of the ways to rationalise it is to say that everything I've done up to date has been rubbish.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great way to legitimize wanting to completely change your life, isn't it? So you can see how it's an easy mindset, an easy thing to fall into. Well, obviously, everything I've done to now obviously has to be complete rubbish, because then that legitimizes the fact that I want to change it all.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, what is it within us that we feel the need to justify? And who are we justifying? Do we think we're justifying everybody else, or are we actually trying to justify it to ourselves?
I think in the beginning we're trying to just to be able to find a way to be able to justify it to everybody else, because right. we have been living everybody else's dream, and we're about to change all that. And it's like, I've got to find a way of being able to talk about this to make it acceptable.
Make it safe.
Make it safe, make it acceptable, make it, you know, so they're not going to shoot me down in flames. I mean, it's interesting because one of the things I say to people when I work with them is, in the beginning, don't talk about this with hardly anybody. Mm. I say there's like three types of friends. You've got your out and out enemies who really, really don't want you to change. And mm-hmm. They could be friends, they could be family, whoever. And I said, they will shoot you down in flames as soon as you start to say anything about change. Yeah. And I said, the only reason they do that is because change terrifies them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you are mirroring to them where they're stuck.
Yeah.
And I said, then the other end of the spectrum is you've got your cheerleaders. And your cheerleaders, I always say, I'm one of your cheerleaders, but your other cheerleaders are probably about two or three friends who are going to keep you going even when you're flagging.
Yeah.
They're going to just make sure you get there. They're not going to let you back out. And I said, and then in the middle, you've got the tricky group, which are what I call your soft enemies. And they look like cheerleaders, but they're actually rather freaked out by this change. And so as soon as you falter, they're going to come in with, oh, never mind, you tried. Yeah. You're fine. You don't need to change. Oh, let's go out to the pub. You know, it's like... They don't know how to relate to you. They're worried, because they're probably quite good friends of yours, they're worried that they're going to lose you.
Yeah.
And so I say to people right at the beginning, this is one of the tips for sure, don't talk about this to hardly anybody, don't talk about it to anybody actually except your cheerleaders, until you're so strong and you're so clear about what you want your life to look like that it doesn't matter what anyone says, you're not going to be put off. And then you can tell the world.
How do you prepare people for the fact that they may lose people in their lives?
I tell them.
Right.
I'm really honest. I don't sugarcoat that one. Well, I might say it in a slightly nicer way. but I say that there are people who may not make the change with you. And I said, but the thing is you can't live your life for them.
No.
And you can't not change because of them. I remember for me, when I went through, you know, probably the first 5 years of when I was really exploring who I was, there were definitely people who went off the screen. But there were also new people who came on.
Yeah.
People who resonated with me, people who wanted the same things as like-minded people. And I had a couple of very old friends who I purposely made the decision I did not want to lose. Mm. And so I knew that whenever I was with them, I had to go back into the old version of Jessica.
Oh, interesting. Oh, wow. How did you manage that, though?
Well, it was just a conscious decision. It was like, you've been in my life for so long and you mean so much to me. And I know, you know, this is the thought process I went through. I know how you can't relate to what I'm interested in now.
Okay.
And yet I value you. I love you. I have great fun when we're together. So, yeah, the old me would come out and we'd go and have fun together. We'd go riding because we both loved horses and do all this stuff together. And I just wouldn't bring up a lot of what I was doing at the moment. It would be more about reminiscing and just spending time together.
Is it the old you, or is it just another version of you that would come out?
I suppose it was another version of me. It was more like the new version, slightly toned down.
Okay. So now people going through this wake up call crisis, for want of a better phrase, have you, but you didn't have you. So how did you go through your own change and metamorphosis?
Yeah, you, a me would have been quite useful.
Well,
when I first packed the two suitcases. I did go, and I had a counsellor who, in fact, was a coach, and I did be with her for a while. And she was the one who recommended quite a lot of these personal development courses. So they sustained me for quite a while as I went through that process. And then I had what I call the second wake-up call in one of the courses I went on. And you know when you're sitting in an audience and the guy up front is talking and he's looking around the audience and every now and again he'll catch your eye for a couple of seconds and then move on and catch somebody else's eye for a couple of seconds. And I'm sitting and he catches my eye, and as he catches my eye, he says the words, "You are God." And then he looks elsewhere, and it was like my mind just stopped. And I have no idea what context those words were in. I'm sure he wasn't looking at me and saying, "You are God." It was in a context of a phrase. But those three words just hit me. Now, I hadn't thought about God ever, really. And I'm sat there for the rest of the day going, "Oh, what does that mean?
Wow.
What does that mean? I know it's true, but what does that mean?" And so that was the beginning of what I would call my spiritual search.
Okay.
And for about a year and a half or so, because this was before I was running the retreat site, I just read everything I could get my hands on and just went, "No, that's not it. No, that's definitely not it." And just kept looking and kept looking. And then when the opportunity to run the retreat site came, I went there because I knew that was more the direction I wanted to go in.
Right.
And I still really didn't know what those words meant until somebody who I was working with in the retreat site came in and gave me a correspondence course. And I read one paragraph of this correspondence course and I went, "Oh, that's it."
Oh, wow. What was it? What was the course?
Well, it was a course from an Indian ashram. So my spiritual path is an Indian spiritual path, and I just knew that it was the right thing. And it's the kind of thing, and I'm a great believer that the right things find you at the right time, and there's not one way in any shape or form. This was just my way that resonated with me. And so I suppose from that point on, that was where my support came from, because that was, I then became, you know, I went out to India and I stayed there for 3 months in the ashram just north of Mumbai.
Oh, in Pune?
No, in a place called Ganeshpuri.
Ah.
And I really became very involved in a way, because it just felt it was truth for me. So that was a lot of where my support came from, because that added a whole new dimension when I started answering that question of what does that "You are God" mean. And so that's where a lot of support for me. And I went and lived in the ashram for 4 years, and I deepened my understanding
in India.
Of that. No, in America.
Okay.
And I deepened my understanding of what that teaching was about.
Right.
And then left America, was supposed to go to London, came to Spain for 2 weeks, liked it, and moved here. And haven't moved since.
As you do. You kind of throw in, so I lived in the ashram for 4 years. How does that work exactly?
Okay, so this is a really funny story. There's lots of weird, wonderful stories around the ashram. I was helping out. I was offering something called SEVA, which is service, and I was doing that in one of the global programs. And I was in a meditation in the global program, and I suddenly got this real hit that I had to go and offer my service in the ashram. And I was like, "I'm not doing that." "I'm not doing that. I'm going to live in Ireland." I'd planned to go and live in Ireland. I was supposed to leave in 3 months' time and go and live in Southern Ireland. "I'm going to Ireland." So I come out, and somebody who I didn't know, who was the MC of the program, walks up to me and says, "I hear you're going to go and live in the ashram." And I'm like, "Oh," and I hadn't said anything to anyone. And I'm like, and out of my mouth comes, "Yes." "Sure, you have to speak to Pat, you know, sort it out." 6 weeks later, I land in bloomin' America going, "What happened?" I volunteered for a year to go and live in the ashram. And then I meet the person who I've been speaking to on the bus the first day. And she said, how long are you here for? And I said, oh, a year. She said, yeah, I thought that. And I said, how long have you been here? She said, 12 years. I said, oh, my goodness. So this is all, you know, surrender on a big level. So I went there and I had a full-time job because we were running the whole global organization from there.
Right.
And my role was in the teacher training department. So I had a fantastic experience. But you're living in that monastic kind of environment. So, you know, there's chants that happen throughout the day, and there's amazing meditation caves where you can't help but meditate because, you know, thousands and thousands of people have meditated there for 30-odd years. So, you know, it has that whole wonderful energy there. And it's an incredible experience to live in an ashram. And it's I feel very blessed to have had that experience. You are constantly learning. You're in what they call the fire of yoga. So although it's very supported, it's also very challenging because all your stuff comes up and you have to look at it because that's what it's about.
Right.
Because it's about that purification of the ego. And I say to people is that, you know, if it's your destiny to go and live in an ashram, you will. But you don't have to. That's not what spirituality is about.
Okay.
You know, we're modern day mystics living in our everyday lives.
Yeah.
And one of the things that one of the Swamis said to me was, you know, you're not supposed to live here the whole time. Because I think I remember saying to her, oh, I could live here forever. And she went, no, that's not what you're here for.
Okay.
You're here to imbibe this and take it out into the world.
And share it.
And so everything I do in all the work that I do is very much coming from that point about connecting to your heart again within and finding what your heart wants, your soul wants, and living from that place.
Right.
And that wake-up call is very much, in my mind, also a spiritual thing because it's about the soul kind of getting through and saying, excuse me, there's a bit more to life than this.
Mm.
What we're doing isn't deeply meaningful. And I think deep meaningfulness, if there's such a word, is what living your spirituality is about.
Well, it's the depth of our existence, isn't it, rather than the surface.
Yeah.
And when I say a lot of people, I think I mean a lot of people in the West, in the developed world, tend to go through life, excuse me, on the surface level.
Yes.
Because it's very driven by materialism, you know, the capitalist society, which is in most of the developed world. There is a pressure on people to fulfill the expectation of the developed world and be materialistic. And it doesn't suit everybody. And it's so easy to get dragged into that, as you did, and a lot of people do. And also, which is even more dangerous, is to look down on people who choose not to.
Yeah.
As being not worthy or lazy.
Yes.
And that's so dangerous, rather than actually realizing they have a lot to teach us. I remember a long time ago, when I was in my early 30s, I was working with education welfare officers in Hampshire. And I went out with an education welfare officer who looked after traveller people, Romany gypsies and travellers.
Yeah.
And how they weren't sending their children to school. And I remember a grandmother in one of these traveller sites said to us, you think you know it all and you're clever, but I'm telling you, if the world economy collapsed, you wouldn't have a hope we would all survive. And I looked and I thought, oh, my Lord, she's absolutely right.
Yeah.
Because we in the developed world, we come to rely too much, don't we, on what that gives us and what that means. And we lose sight of the true human spirits and the depth of that. And we don't give ourselves time to dig further below our own surface.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we're bombarded every day with the stuff we have to be happy.
Yeah, crazy, you know?
And, you know, the new phone, the one you've got works fine, but you need to have a new one. And the new car, although the one you've got right now works fine. And that whole thing, it's very interesting. Living in the south of Spain, even though it is obviously a capitalist kind of country, the south of Spain is very family orientated,
mm-hmm.
and where I live has really suffered in the global crisis.
Right.
You know, there's 45-50% unemployment.
Wow.
Among young people, 40-odd% unemployment among older people, because we relied on tourism and building, and both of which have fallen through the floor. But it's very interesting to watch that the community has stepped in. And family has taken care of family. And there's very few homeless on the streets. There's a couple of people, obviously, outside the supermarkets, you know, wanting change. But there's and the church has also stepped in. I think in the town I live in, the church is feeding something like 6,000 families.
Wow.
And everybody buys food and takes it to the distribution centre. So, you know, if they are either looking after their own family or they're looking after someone else's family. And I love that. I think, you know, it's beautiful to see. And I think in a lot of larger cities, we don't have that kind of community. Mm. We don't know how to look after each other.
Mm.
And for me, that's just a demonstration of how wonderful the human spirit is.
Yeah, yeah. Because it is, actually. You strip away the surface glamour, and actually, on a soul level, we're all equal across the globe, aren't we?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And what we do to others, we do to ourselves.
Yeah.
And I think that's you know, it's like when we're in touch with our humanity, we're in touch with our soul and our spirit. Then we can come from that place, and then, you know, what we put out into the world is far better.
Yeah. So you went to Spain for 2 weeks and stayed.
Yeah.
How long ago was that?
15 years ago.
15 years ago. Wowza.
Yep.
And have you always been doing your retreats and your coaching in those 15 years?
I started coaching about 13 years ago.
Right.
And when I first came to Spain, I worked as a landscape gardener because I didn't know the language, and plants don't care what language they talk to you. English was fine. And I knew how to do gardening. And so we literally went up, packed one car up in England, packed another car. My partner comes from Switzerland. We drove two cars down to Spain and started a life here.
Good grief.
And I thought I had a job, which fell through after 2 weeks, so I really had to get going at that point. I didn't have anything, no money or anything behind me. And in fact, the first summer we were here, we survived out of a friend's vegetable garden.
Fantastic.
I used to get food parcels every month, every week.
Wow.
So talk about community. But then I decided I wanted to be a coach. And I don't know how much time we have left, but I want to tell you just a very quick story, if we have time. I wanted to become a coach. I didn't have any money to go and be able to do it. But I got absolutely clear that I was passionate about working as a coach.
Right.
And I met somebody and was bending his ear. I didn't really know him very well, but I was bending his ear about this passion. And he rang me up the next day and he said to me, "You're so passionate about what you do. You're so clear what you want to do." He said, "You don't know this, but I'm a trainer and I'm a coach." And he says, "And I'm going to train you for free."
Wow.
"I don't think you should wait."
Wow.
So that's what clarity, that's what passion does.
Yeah.
It opens doors. And I'm so, so clear about that for everybody that I've ever worked with. Once you get clear on what you really, really want, what you're really passionate about in life, you don't have to know how.
No, it's the why, isn't it? If you know the why, the how will take care of itself. Well, absolutely. You are a living testament of that. That's brilliant. So tell us about your retreats. What how long are they for? What do you do with people?
What do I do with them? I take them away up into the Spanish mountains. Yeah, I do them here in Spain.
Right.
Just up in the mountains near here is an area called the Alpujarras, and it's a beautiful old Moorish, lots of Moorish kind of walkways in the mountains. And we have 2 days of full days away. So they come out on the first day. We have 2 days up in the mountain and go home on the fourth day. And each retreat is completely different.
Right.
Because what I do is before somebody comes on retreat, I have a session with them and I get them to set an intention. And then we serve that intention.
Okay.
And I bring my metaphorical toolbox with me. And then whatever we need to do is what we do. And what I have is we have a session at least 4 hours every morning of the 2 mornings we're there. And then the afternoons there's like at least 3 hours of just silence. Just let it all kind of filter through, and then we have another session in the evening before we have dinner. And it's a quite an intensive time, and that's why it's only 2 days.
Yeah.
Somebody said, can we do a week? And I went, no, really, you don't want to do a week. 2 days is absolutely fine, because what I always do is have work with people for at least 4 months afterwards.
Right.
So that we can roll out what's come up on the retreat. But it's a wonderful starting place, because we can get into some really, really deep conversations in those days that can make a huge shift.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. How frequently do you run them?
Whenever people want, because they're individual.
Okay.
The dates are to suit. I did think about doing group retreats, but I really like the individual one-on-one time with people. And when we have that, that works really well. So we literally just look at diaries and find a time and arrange it whenever it suits.
Sounds magical. So people can find out at your website, which will be on the link to this interview, jessicamcgregorjohnson.com.
That's it, yes.
Brilliant. Absolutely. In 30 seconds, what's the future holding for you?
Oh, expansion. That's the word that comes to me. I just feel that everything is expanding, and I feel that I'm just going to carry on doing what I do. That's the interesting thing. I love what I do, and I actually don't want any of it to change. I just want to do it more and in with some amazing people, and just getting the message out. I do have on my website something called the Life Lessons, which is for 6 months. It's free. It's an online course that everybody can get. It's every 2 weeks you get an email. It drops, and it's about how to live life. And so, as well as my coaching and retreats, you know, to make what I want to put out in the world more accessible to people who maybe can't afford to come with me, that's another way that you can interact with me and have that.
Perfect. Thank you, Jessica. That's a great way to end. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been wonderful.
So you've been listening to Creating Ripples. Listen in and be part of the revolution that is rocking the world. Women over 50 are the new future. We are awesome, fearless, fabulous, inspiring, passionate, courageous. In fact, we just rock.